Guys, awesome. Why don't you turn with me to Acts chapter 23. Kind of left Paul in danger again, so we got to go get him. Has your mouth ever gotten you in trouble before? Daily? It was Calvin Coolidge that said, "I have never been hurt by anything I didn't say." But unfortunately, we have to talk. And unfortunately, oftentimes our mouth gets us in trouble. And somebody had asked, if you were given a dime for every nice thing that you said, or given a nickel for every unkind word that you said, would you be rich or poor? Very good question. I'll let you just kind of think on that for just a little bit. We're going to find a place where Paul's mouth gets him in trouble. And how he, you know, kind of the different things that he goes through, and how God, how Jesus comes and restores him. And so I think we can all kind of relate to that aspect. But something I want you to be thinking about for the very end of the message is this. Do you relate more to God as servant to master or child to father? And so be thinking about that one, and we'll address that more towards the end. Well, in Acts chapter 23, matter of fact, we'll pick it up in the very last verse of chapter 22, where Claudius Lysias, the Roman guard that has him under guard, and is basically turns Paul over to the Sanhedrin, about 70 to 71, the Jewish rulers that are going to judge him next. So picking up in verse 30 of chapter 22. Next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and their council to appear, and brought Paul down and set him before them. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. And Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall." You can kind of see where his tongue kind of gets him a little bit in trouble here. "For you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?" And those who stood by said, "Do you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" Let's pause right there. I call this tongue-in-cheek lashing, both of them taking place right here. He says, "I have lived in all good conscience before God." In the Greek, literally, "I have lived as a citizen with God." What he's basically telling them is, "I am not guilty, and you're wrong in judging me." He's basically saying my charges are baseless, and that's why the high priest gets just really agitated here. But the high priest's action was definitely unwarranted and illegal, because in this little court system that they have put together here, you were supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, and obviously he strikes out here. There was actually a Jewish oral tradition at the time, and it said this, I quote, "He who strikes the cheek of an Israelite strikes, as it were, the glory of God." And so it's very serious to take and strike him at this time. Paul's response in verse 3, "God will strike you." Now, this actually seems to be pretty prophetic, because it's only a couple years later this absolutely gets fulfilled. Ananias, the high priest, actually gets deposed and then is assassinated. He had very pro-Roman sentiments for this Jewish high priest, and so he is assassinated by these anti-Roman Jewish revolutionaries in 66 AD. And so as he tells them that God will strike you, in fact he did a couple years later. But then he goes on to call him a whitewashed wall. That's contrasting a decent exterior to an indecent, an unclean interior. Jesus used that, obviously talking about as they would take the limestone and they would clean it up so you didn't accidentally lean against one of these tombstones, especially if their people were traveling down for Passover, something like that. Because if you touched a dead body or something related to a dead body like a tombstone and you leaned up against it not knowing it was one, you'd be defiled and you'd trekked all the way down to Jerusalem for nothing and you didn't get to go worship and present your sacrifice and such. So they would whitewash them and they'd look really nice on the outside, but what's inside is dead men's bones, and that's of course that analogy that Jesus gave, but Paul's using it here a little bit more brash, whitewashed wall. And then he says in the middle of verse 3, "For you sit to judge me according to the law. Do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?" So you're holding me to the law, but you're not held to the law. And so basically saying you are a stinking hypocrite. So you can understand why Ananias is, tweak with the whole situation. I call this apostolic flesh, okay? Now, some disagree with me, because in verse 5 where he says, Paul says, when they say, "Hey, what are you doing reviling God's high priest?" And he says, "I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest." He's basically saying, for your right, and he quotes out of Exodus, "You should not speak evil of the ruler of your people." And so, a few different ideas. Paul didn't know his tormentor's identity because of his defective vision. We know Paul had had bad eyesight. It tells us in Galatians. He says, "I write to you with very large letters." And so he had some type of eye disease at the time. And so he actually couldn't see him. Now understand, it's a half arc. It's a half circle of 71 men. And so maybe he didn't hear that it was coming from the center where the high priest would sit. And so there's that possibility. Second idea is that Paul was speaking in irony, saying he didn't act like a high priest. So how could I recognize him as one? He was totally out of character. So maybe it was irony. Or it was possible that because this Claudius Lysias told them, "Put this together right away," maybe the high priest didn't have on his garment at the time, and Paul wouldn't have known Ananias. It had been 20 years since he had sat on the Sanhedrin, and so with that he wouldn't have known him nor recognized him. Or number 4, Paul completely lost his cool. Kind of failure of in self-control. I kind of lean on that last one because of some of the other things that are going to that are about to come up here. But at any rate, Paul's acknowledgement of his error was very prompt and recognized the position of the high priest, even if he didn't respect the person. And with that, that's pretty important, I believe, for us to do also. When God places a government official over us, whether that's local courts all the way up to our national court, we need to be careful of the same thing. Ecclesiastes 10:20 says, "Do not curse the king even in your thought." And so with that, we're reminded of Romans 13, that it is God who raises them up, those in leadership over us. And so we need to always make sure that we at least esteem the office, even sometimes when people are in office that we can't esteem that highly. But in the heat of the moment, Paul said the wrong thing, wrong person. And I think this is the worst part of that, and probably what he grieved over was the lost opportunity, not only for a fair trial, but most importantly, he blew his chance at explaining the gospel. Because as he's going to go from court to court, he's going to spend 2 years in the next destination that he goes with before he even gets down to Rome. And with that, it's his goal at each of these places. He's already shared that with us a number of times to be able to present the gospel to him. But boy, that just shut everything down right there. And he knew that he blew his opportunity there. And so situation kind of turns ugly. He's got to think fast to get out alive. Verse 6. "But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, 'Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, that I am being judged.' When he had said this, a dissension arose between the and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. Then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, 'We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God.' Now when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks." And so he's got to go save him one more time. In verses 6 through 10 here, I call this flashpoint. The definition of flashpoint is the critical stage in some process, event, or situation at which action, change, or violence occurs. I know it's a new TV show, but here at this aspect of the flashpoint of everything just erupting immediately, and that's what takes place here. Very strategic statement polarizes the whole council. He had been involved with the Sanhedrin before. He knows who makes up the Sanhedrin. And so he kind of just takes a grenade and just lobs it out there, playing his Pharisee card. And it worked for a little bit. Took the heat off Paul temporarily. But Paul at this time seems to be sitting in his cell as they grab him and pull him back into the barracks. We're at the Temple Mount there in Jerusalem in the Antonia Fortress. And there he finds himself back in this cell, most likely sitting in guilt's ashes. Explosive anger, dealing with that, what he missed out on. We've all felt that before because we did something. Now we know it's going to change a whole course on where we could have gone and where we can't go now, and just struggling through those things. And the Lord comes to him right at the right time. Look at verse 11. But the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome." I love what Chuck Swindoll said. He said, "With a cool breeze of grace, Jesus blew away the stagnant memories of Paul's failure. Only the grace of God," he continued to say, "can carve a roadway of peace through a person's wilderness of guilt and a coarse river through a desert of despair." See, the Lord loves doing that. And so you could just imagine him just being frustrated and just, "I blew it, I had the chance." In standing in front of the whole council there to be able to present the gospel in such a clear manner, and I blew it. I let my mouth go and I blew it. But what does the Lord do? The Lord appears to him and shows up and ministers to him. In Isaiah 43, it says, "See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the desert and streams in the wasteland." And the Lord will do that in our lives. We might be just completely dried out, and he's going to bring a stream our way and to be able to make the land flourish one more time. Paul has the best lawyer available here, and Paul knew better than anyone, if Christ is for you, who can be against you? He was the one who wrote that in the book of Romans. And so after 2 days of great mental strain and emotional strain and spiritual, this vision comes as such beautiful provision for him. Here it says, the following night. Christ always seems to appear in our darkest hour, showing up at just that right time. And it says, and the Lord stood by him. And as the Lord stands by him, he doesn't bring any rebuke, simply words of encouragement. Just like the woman that was caught in the very act of adultery thrown at his feet. Not a word of rebuke. She's caught. She's busted. He doesn't even have to deal with her sin in that way. He waits till the crowd leaves and he says, "Where's all your accusers?" And then has this encouragement conversation with her and is able to say, "Go and sin no more. Don't continue in that same form of sin. Stop doing that." That's obviously important. But there's no big rebuke or anything else. It was all pure love. And so he comes and stands by him. Paul realizes what he did. And as he's sitting there, he comes up and he says, "Be of good cheer." Why is he saying that? Well, because he wasn't. And so he's saying to cheer up. And it's actually in the present imperative, he suggests that he began to despond or give up hope. And so that's why he's telling him here to be of good cheer. And then each one of these lines are just so important because he says, you testified of me in Jerusalem. You know what that is? That's Jesus' stamp. What do we deal with for the last two chapters? But all of his friends, prophets, and everybody coming to him saying, "Don't you dare go to Jerusalem." Matter of fact, the Spirit says you shouldn't go to Jerusalem. And he struggled with that aspect of, "Well, but I feel bound in my spirit that he told me to go." And finally told him, "Enough, I'm going to Jerusalem." And here's Jesus showing up after the fact, giving his stamp, saying, "Hey, you were a witness to me in Jerusalem." Kind of like saying, "Thanks. And you know what? Now I'm going to give you your next mission. You're going to get the desire of your heart, and I'm going to send you to Rome. You will be a witness to me in Rome." Now Jesus shows up and tells you, "Hey, get in the boat and go on the other side." There's something that you can know. You're going to get to the other side. Doesn't mean there's not going to be a storm out in the middle, but you're going to get to the other side. And so I'm sure some just radical assurance floating in his mind and all the way down to his bones here, because the Lord says, "You're going to be a witness to me in Rome." So if he gets in a shipwreck and a few other things along the way, he knows he's going to get down to Rome. Something that doesn't take place here, the pressure isn't relieved. He doesn't find himself in a Peter situation where he says, "Doors of jail open, sesame," or whatever, you know, and then he's able to walk out and walk out. No, he's still in the cell and he's not going to get out, and he's going to finish his life that way. He's in as as he's been abducted here. And so the pressure was not relief, but the worker was supported and strengthened. Haven't you moved in that way in your prayers before? God, get me out of this situation. God, get me out of this situation. And then pretty soon, God, get me through the situation. Just get me through it. Okay, I can see. You're not going to get me out of this situation. Would you give me the strength to be able to endure? You're not going to take this heavy load off my back. Can you just walk beside me and kind of just lift it a little bit, please? Give me the strength to be able to get to the end. And ultimately, that's what he's doing here. And so God's present through all of our circumstances, especially when we need him the most. And so he appears. Let's go on to verse 12. And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Now there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. They came to the chief priests and elders and says, "We have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him. But we are ready to kill him before he comes near." So when Paul's sister's son heard of their ambush, he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. The Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, "Take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the commander and said, "Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you." Then the commander took him by the hand and went aside and asked privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they are going to inquire more fully about him. But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you." And so the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, "Tell no one that you have revealed these things to me." Dun, 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 dun. The big conspiracy. 40 angry radical Jews on a hunger strike, and they want Paul dead. But only the Lord could have worked this situation out. Seems it's just a terrible situation, but there the Lord is working. Always working, he seems to always do it in combo. This supernatural grace and this very, using also natural means. Supernatural grace and very natural means. And we'll watch as they put these two together here. Paul's nephew happened to live in the city. And by the providence of God, he discovers this Jewish plot. You never know what friend a relative or even enemy God will use, maybe even an unlikely eavesdropper, as he does here. And so God beautifully working this whole thing of convergence. It's like a whole bunch of rivers coming together as one strong river. And so he's going to use his nephew here, and he's going to use these Jewish radicals here and the Romans and this Claudius Lysias, the commander, and each of them to bring about. See, God is going to get his man to Rome where he wants him to witness. And he'll use anybody and everybody to be able to get him there. But it's amazing how God pulled this all off. An otherwise unknown nephew just happens to hear the plot and somehow enters this heavily guarded barracks to tell Paul. Then the centurion was willing to take him to the commander. He could have blew him off and said, "Get this kid out of here. Who are you? You're the prisoner. I don't have to listen to you." A centurion was willing to take him to the commander. I already said that, sorry. Busy commander listened to him right away and believed him. The commander ordered a small army to escort Paul out of town in the time of darkness. And we'll read that in just a minute. But see, when God makes a promise, he keeps it with remarkable style. As he says, "I am going to do this in your life," he's going to bring it about. And he'll use all the different means in his kingdom to be able to bring that about. But let's learn a couple of important truths before we move on. Number one, the grace of God can overshadow any guilt within. And the power of God can overcome any plot against us, okay? So the grace of God helping us to deal with any guilt on the inside. The power of God to overcome any plot that is against us. Maybe you're wandering in a wilderness of guilt. And you've confessed to God 100 times over, "Lord, forgive me for what I did." And you don't even realize he did so long ago. And it's just you that are the one that are continuing to swell in all of this guilt. Maybe you're in a lost in a desert of despair. And life is just absolutely just dried up. Either way, it's his grace, the grace of God and the power of God. That becomes the cool springs, God's grace and his power in your life. And that's what you ought to be seeking. Because he loves coming in, even at the last moment, but to be able to come in with his refreshment and just flow upon you once again, his grace and his power. Pick it up in verse 23, and he called for two centurions, saying, prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea in the third hour of the night, that'd be 9 p.m., and provide mounts to set Paul on, so he even gets to go on horseback, that's pretty awesome, and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. And he wrote a letter in the following manner. Kind of fun to read a letter from the first century now. Granted, the book of Acts is the same thing, but this is one. Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Well, that's not really true. Remember, he had rescued him so he wouldn't lose his own job on the Temple Mount there because he had to keep peace. And it was when he was ready to beat the snot out of him when he found out he was a Roman. Then he stopped. He said, okay, let's not whip him. That's the truth. But anyways, but I like that. I rescued him having learned that he was a Roman. No, you didn't. Verse 28. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. Found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. Then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. Antipatris is almost on the coast. And then the rest of the way, they just run right up the Mediterranean there, right up the coastline up to Caesarea, about a 65-mile journey. The next day, they left the horsemen to go on with him and return to the barracks. And so the 70 horsemen, they go on back. The rest of them, they continue on to Caesarea. Verse 34. When the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. When he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear you when your accusers also have come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium, or his headquarters, his palace guard there. Detachment of 470 soldiers are prepared to transport Paul from Jerusalem to Caesarea, and they all get overtime. It's 9 o'clock at night. I don't know if they get overtime or not, but you know what I mean. Paul's escort went to extraordinary lengths to ensure his safety for the trip. Pretty incredible. Again, when God says, I'm going to have you go witness in Rome. Now, originally when he wanted to go to Rome, I imagine he thought he was going as a free man. But all that to say, God is going to give him there. And with pretty much pomp and circumstance, he is going to guard him and make sure that he gets there safely. I had a very interesting opportunity on Friday that I wanted to share with you just because it was just hilarious. I had the opportunity to become a driver in John McCain's motorcade on Friday. And it was Randon Lane, who is a member of our church here, a friend, and he works as one of our ushers and is running for city council, also with Doug. And with that, he had called me up, Randon did, and he says, hey, do you want to be a driver on Saturday? And he told me about it, and I thought, you know, I can't do a Saturday. It's a study day, and that won't work. So he called me back. Hey, there's one opening Friday. You want to do it? And I said, yeah, it'd just be a lot of fun. Just kind of see how the whole thing takes place. So we go down there, and it's just funny working with the Secret Services. Everything is, he's going to come in at 5 or 7. It'll be the Long Beach Airport or John Wayne Airport. Everything's in twos, and they never tell you until the last second to do that. So it's kind of funny. So anyways, so we have these five vans, and we're being led and followed by the Secret Service in their smoked-out Suburbans. And so we go and pick everything up and get everything ready. Then when it's time, we go down to the John Wayne Airport. We pull out front. Open up all our vans, bomb-sniffing dog goes through all of them. Then we wait for our time. Still don't know. It's either 5 or 7 when he's coming in. So we're waiting inside for a while. Then we're told, get back in your van. We get in our vans, and they open up the gate to the tarmac. We go out on the tarmac. We line up all of our cars. You're feeling pretty bad at this point. It's pretty awesome. Okay. And so the cops everywhere, and we're waiting for the jet to pull up. So you're expecting some just beautiful leer with, you know, flags on the side or something. This old beater jet comes up, and that's it. And they start moving. And they say, said, you got to be on it. And if they're not in your car vehicle in 1 minute, you take off without them and we're gone. Don't get lost, you know, don't get left behind. So it's like, okay. So we're all nervous at this point. This is where it's all happening. And so as everybody comes up, I got voted fifth van, so I'm last van. Well, as everybody pulls up, I can't see anything. I'm behind everybody. And so I'm looking like this. I just want to get a glimpse of John McCain, and I'm looking, and I never get to see him. So then the Secret Service is opening all of our doors and shuttling everybody in, his family, getting them into the Suburbans, and then the staffers, they're in the next two vans, and then all of the press that go with them in the next ones. And he comes up to my van and he says, I'm going to go ahead and keep yours closed because I don't think we're going to need yours. They didn't bring as many people, and slams my van. So it's like, hey, come on, just one reporter, come on, you know. And so, boom, we're off and going, and we're down the streets, and the two Suburbans are constantly just moving around like that, so you don't know which one he's in, and it was just a blast to be a part of the whole thing. So I'm thinking, okay, we pull up the hotel, be able to see him then. So I'll pull up in the hotel, I'm on the curve behind a tree, come on, I just want to, you know, just, I never got to see him, so... But it was sure a blast just to watch this whole thing, just to be able to escort a presidential nominee 15 minutes from this airport to this hotel there in Costa. It was a lot of fun. But anyways, okay, so that's the only way I could figure out how to work it into my text was right here where it says, let's wrap up. You know, as... He sets up Paul, and we'll pick it up next week where he goes to his next appointment, you know, where he has to speak to Felix. He'll be dealing with the governor next. And he's waiting there, again, up on the Temple Mount, in the Antonia Fortress, there in Herod's Praetorium. And, he's already up to Caesarea, so he's in there. That was the Roman headquarters was in Caesarea there, right on the beach and on the Mediterranean there. And so that's where he lies. But I wanted to end in asking you, go back to what I asked in the beginning, in your relationship with the Lord, because we definitely see that tenderness here between Jesus and Paul. And I ask the question, do you relate to God more as a servant to a master or as a child to a father? That might depend on some of your background, maybe some of my religious background, and that is just wanting to be serving and used and making sure I'm doing. And obviously that's important, and God does want us to serve. I'm not putting that down in any way. But well, let me quote from this. David Siemens in his book, Healing Grace, he said this, "The servant is accepted and appreciated on the basis of what he does. The child on the basis of who he is. The servant starts the day anxious and worried, wondering if his work will really please his master. But the child rests in the secure love of his family. The servant is accepted because of his workmanship, the son or daughter because of relationship. And one more, the servant is accepted because of productivity and performance, but the child belongs because of his position as a person." I think it's why Paul said this in Galatians 4. "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman and born under the law, to redeem those who are under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. And because you're sons, God has sent forth the spirit of his son into your hearts, crying out, Abba, Father. Therefore, you are no longer a slave," where we get our word servant. "You're no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir of God through Christ." A lot of times I think we have this wrong view of our God, that he's just some taskmaster. That the reason he saved your soul is for you to do, and running around getting all these things done. Because without you, I couldn't get it done. I don't think that's it. Of course, there's things that he has planned before the foundation of the world. But I see that all as a blessing for Brian, a blessing for the world, but you know, all those different things in which he's working. But first and foremost, he says, Brian, he doesn't picture you as a slave of his. He pictures you as his son, and he wants you crying out to him, Abba, Father. During that time of guilt, during that time of hurting, during the time of sitting in your cell with your hands in your head in your hands and just saying, I blew it, and how could God ever use me again? I blew that witnessing opportunity. I had the opportunity and I didn't take it because I chickened out or whatever it is. And thinking that he can't. And there's God, he comes right alongside you. arm around you, reminding you, hey, didn't I work these things in your life when you did this? Hey, and way to go and doing this over here. And here's what I have planned for you in the future, so we don't just sit there and continue to stew in our own little pity party, but to be able to, hey, look what I've done, and look what I want to do. Let's go, and let's get going again. That's the relationship he wants with us. Father, we thank you for that very, very special privilege, being able to be one of your sons or daughters. And thank you for that great love that you have for us. And we realize then that you spank us when we need spanks, just like as a parent does to a child. Discipline when we need discipline, but also, Lord, encouragement when we need encouragement. We thank you, Lord, for that relationship, that we're not just a bunch of slaves running around, ready just to run around doing and doing and doing until we're burnt out. We thank you for a sweet, sweet family love, a wonderful relationship. Lord, may we continue to grow in our understanding of what it is to be able to call you Abba, Father. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand. In fact, our Redeemer does live. He seeks to come alongside you and encourage you and comfort you. And I pray that he does that in your life this week. Lord, bless you. And if we can pray for anyone, we invite you to come on up. God bless.